It's time for The Citizen Lobbyist, a discussion of local, borough, and state politics featuring Terry Snyder and Mike Malefsky.
Good morning, Citizen Lobbyist.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I didn't have to stay quite as late as you did. Tuesday, that went on. What time did the Borough Assembly meeting finish up?
That's the longest one we've had in a long time. I think it ran till 10:30. I think they extended it 10:45 at one point, but I think we got out of there before that. But they left a lot of unfinished business on the table. So the next one ought to be very lively because they're going to have a lot of work to do.
Well, maybe we should start with that. I do want to cover both meetings because there were some interesting things at the school board meeting yesterday, and I was there and listened to that, of course. But let's start with Tuesday. So what happened at that lengthy meeting?
Well, first of all assembly members were present, which I always like to report, Mike, that everybody shows up, we're in their seats, ready to go, along with the mayor and manager, attorney, and other staff. Started out with a report from the cities, as it normally does, Mike. Just a real short one from Mayor Cottle about some events that are happening with the library in his city, and Pop Warner Skills Camp is coming up. And then Nate Wallace from the city, because there wasn't a council meeting. Often there is a conflict there. Came and gave a quick report on, first, about an event they're going to have March 14th at the depot about future development of downtown. This is concerning what's called a Brownsville grant that the borough received for area-wide planning. I know you talked about it, Mike, last time you were at the Palmer meeting, and I see that it's on the agenda again next Tuesday, so there will be more information next Tuesday at the Palmer City Council meeting about it. He talked a little bit about the budget and the uncertainty of the community, about the budget and the state budget and how it will affect them. He has determined that revenue sharing would, if it's eliminated from the governor's budget, will cost the city of Palmer about $165,000 or 0.5 of their revenues, which is basically one police officer or 25% of the library budget. So he was just kind of did it pretty well, saying, you know, what happens down there does affect the citizens of Palmer, and that they are at the willing to support appropriate resolutions for support that the borough might come up with about the budget. And, you know, things like they are worried about the increase of cost of the Pioneer homes. And even though UAA is outside of the city here in the borough, it does have concern cuts there could be jobs that are cut and will affect Palmer as well and students. So just overall kind of about their concerns and watching and wanting to sort of work in unison to support from the Valley any changes that that they all have to endure.
Right.
Then the school district gave a quick update also from Amy Spargo, who is the assistant superintendent. She Monica Goya, the district superintendent, was in Juneau giving a presentation to House Finance, so she was not there. She just gave a pretty quick overview, and it was pretty wrapped up. They gave a budget award for their finance director for a financial service award, national award that the borough had received. That's always nice to have those given. And then the manager had some quick comments having to do with his trip to Juneau with Assemblyman Jesse Sumner when they met with the governor and a lot of other meetings. They are concerned, the top thing they seem concerned about is the fairness on the clawback of the bond money from the state. We talked about that last week, Mike. The 70-30 split on the 2011 bonds that were passed. And kind of the lay of the land very quickly on that. And that was followed up with a very well-done presentation having to do with our EMS department and a piece of legislation that was on the borough agenda but was kicked down the road till March 19th having to do with transiting on-call responders, which is the bulk of what we have for EMS in the Valley, to paid responders. And so they gave a really good presentation just about the enormous growth. It's just mind-boggling how challenging it has been, because the call volume has doubled, I think, since 2010 or more. And they have four ambulances that are going 24/7. They're going to be asking for two more to cover the Valley. It's become a real problem when they have a big accident, and we know they've had several on KGB. They just had one in the Parks not long ago, or not Parks, the Glen, not Parks, of Parks Highway not long ago, north of Willow, tied up three of their ambulances. First time I've heard them talk about the key factors being the big growth in the aging population here. That there are now, there in 2015, there were 32 what they call retirement homes. I would say that's probably assisted living in the borough, and there's now 96 of them, with another one, big one, going online here early. And that is the one thing. The seniors do contribute to the health community here, because they need a lot more health care as they get older. And, of course, just the population growth and the opiate use, and it's just really maxed out their system. So really good part. Talked about the tourism. Oddly, something I didn't know, Mike, that people come to see Alaska. Oftentimes they skip treatment that they're having. They want that last thing to do to come and see Alaska. So they end up taking care of a lot of tourists that come up here, when they're, even the ones in the cruise ships who have doctors on board. Once they get off board, they don't have a doctor. And so they end up having tons and tons of response during the summer. So they don't really have any downtime anymore. So they're going to be asking for that, to hire, I think, 17 EMTs and eight paramedics. I can't remember what the breakdown is now, but we'll discuss that next time. But it's going to be a lively conversation. But there certainly is no question, I don't think, that if the service is getting bigger and bigger, and how we go about that is going to be an interesting conversation, and how that affects, you know, the budget with so much uncertainty. So that was kind of it, Mike. They did move sort of the big thing that we talked about to the beginning of the meeting, and that had to do with the ordinance about air quality in the Butte. You've been following this, haven't you, Mike?
Sure, and for listeners, a reminder, what was the ordinance intending to do?
You know, it was intending to sort of get in front of the problem of air quality problems that we have had over the year in Butte because of inversion, and had to do specifically, can't be said enough, to outside burning. Did not have to do with wood stoves, although there was a lot of misinformation about that. It had to do with open burning that caused the air quality to come down so bad that we have been in violation of the Clean Air Act. That's a federal requirement. And there has been months and months of back and forth, lots of public interaction about this. There was a full room of people clearly still not convinced that it was just open burning, that they were still, some of them, convinced that the borough was trying to take away their wood stoves, which absolutely had nothing to do with this ordinance. And the intent of the ordinance was to try to get show the federal government that we were actually taking some action, so that the borough does not fall into what they consider non-attainment areas like Fairbanks and Juneau did. I think Fairbanks has ended up spending about over $8 million in fines and remedies trying to get out of this non-attainment status. And the borough has really worked hard for several years trying to figure out a good spot to get into, to be able to be proactive in showing the federal government that, they were doing something, even though it's a small certain days, and every year is different, that we're doing something about non-attendance. So there was a lot of, I didn't count them, Mike, but there were a lot of people that testified on this, pros and cons. I mean, there certainly was an organized group that has kind of gone along, and we've seen, Mike, over the last couple of years that kind of were armed with some, I think it's fair to say, misinformation from a gentleman that is proposing he run for assembly next time. And he had certainly had them there, and they did testify. Some of it just worried that it was an overreach of the federal government. Again, we've heard that come around again. But at the end of the day, Mike, very vibrant conversation on the assembly. Lots of back and forth. The lead on opposition was Assemblyman Jesse Sumner. He, even though he seemed to agree on the situation, because the new Department of the DEC director from the state is somebody that he knows, he didn't like the fix. He just thinks we should just let the federal government do what the federal government's going to do. So and he had some fair points, I think, about the fact that the borough lacks the manpower and resources to enforce some of their ordinances. And he felt that this was just another something that they could not enforce. There is a fee schedule on it, very minimal fee schedule. But it's a deterrent, like everything else that we put law in, is to say, yeah, it is, you know, there is a law against doing it. So at the end of the day, Mike, it was a 4-3 vote with the three dissenting votes. People that did not want it was Ted Leonard, George McKee, and Jesse Sumner.
And I heard a little bit of Ted Leonard's explanation of why he voted as he did, and he had some concerns about changes down the road to the ordinance that would be have a negative impact.
Well, I think it's back to the, we hear this sometimes, kind of what I'd say the more conservative sides of legislators who are, it's that camel's nose under the tent,
right,
sort of thing,
yeah,
that you don't want to start any type of regulation. That even though there was an amendment passed, sort of an addendum to the presented legislation that clearly said no wood stove, he was just not convinced that this was not going to lead to bigger government restrictions.
Okay. But in any case, it passed. And
it passed.
Okay.
So that one's done. You know, that was probably the biggest thing that they talked about there. But it was kind of a contentious little assembly meeting that we haven't seen for a while. And but at the end of the day, it did get done, and they've kicked several things down the road to March 19th. I talked earlier about the ambulance of the EMS, that they didn't take up the wastewater and septic advisory board meeting changes in that, or the driveways. So they're going to have a full slate, and I think they start at 3 p.m. on the 19th, too, Mike. So
okay,
it's going to be a long one. So how did the school board go?
Okay.
Is it that lively?
This was a different school board meeting, although it began in what might be called a normal way. There were, I think there are at least three things I might comment upon. The major intention of the school board meeting was to have a presentation, and in this case, Luke Fulp was out of town, taking a little rest, well-earned rest. And so the superintendent, Monica Goyette, did provide a report to the school board and the audience, basically going over materials that are available on the website. So anyone who had missed the meeting can go to the website, and you'll see some pretty well-developed graphics, et cetera. Yesterday, Jillian Morrissey was in, and in the Inside the Schools section, of the programming we do. She went over this as kind of a preview of it, so that also will be up on the website. So you got a variety of ways you can catch that presentation, see the materials. And the first step was to demonstrate that the Matsu Borough School District is doing quite well. In two ways. One, very definitely doing well as compared to other school districts in the state or the country in terms of students' performance. And she just stressed that and said, happy and available to talk with anyone who suggests that there haven't been improvements. This is not to say that it is perfect, but obviously the data that's been collected about students is significant, and it's there. The second part of that was to point out that a large amount of money goes directly to schools and to instruction. The various calculations and numbers that are used, but this is and it has been for years, known as a very thin administration, central administration, to keep a school district of 19,000 students going. This is not in terms of dollar amounts, percentages, et cetera. You could clearly show where all those monies were going, et cetera. The next part of it, having set a foundation, was to provide a budget that looked at the possibilities of what might happen down the road, looking at the governor's proposals and what and so on, and came up with a balanced budget discussion to say this is somewhat pessimistic, and I'm not quite sure yet still, as time goes on, if it appears, and there's some considerable suggestion that the governor's proposals regarding reducing funding to education will not hold, the district will survive. She quite clearly pointed out that if those proposals, the impact of the proposals, what would happen. But it wasn't presented in a way that says, here you are, this is a disaster, et cetera. What she was saying was our intention is to have a school district that will function well, and we're looking at ways in which we can make that continue to happen. I think given the lack of clarity about just what educational funding will be at this point, there are glimmers enough of light. And she's been down there and testifying, and people have been back and forth. And as you know, there are many people that are supportive of a different kind of budgeting for education, and not the governor's. I think there was somewhat of a feeling of optimism. There was also an interesting, and I had not heard this before, this is an interesting kind of legislative governor dance regarding vetoes. Coming into this, my understanding had been that it's possible that the legislature would offer up a bill funding differently than the governor, and then the governor would have the opportunity to line item veto. But it turns out, as what I heard last night, was there was another possibility. There had been a budget essentially approved last year with the Walker administration. And if no changes are made to that, it is veto-proof. Because it will not be presented as a new bill to the governor for his signing. So I'd say
it is the last approved budget by the legislature, but isn't it time sensitive? I guess it is the projection. That's a projection of this year. That's not a projection of next year, which is what they're working on.
Right, but the deal is that which was done could be presented as is, And I have to explore more the intricacies of this, but there appear to be three choices. One, the governor's budget with the accompanying bills be the one that's voted on and approved or whatever. Or the legislature could come up with its own new version. Or there's this legacy version that will go into effect if the legislature doesn't create a new one. And that is not subject to the governor's veto. A line item veto. So what I'm saying is it was a very interesting thing. I'm going to pursue it a bit more. We'll get more about that.
Yeah.
But then there were also last night, and I would invite people to listen to the recording, and it'll be up this morning, where the president, Dearman, said she wanted to take the opportunity to set the record straight. And maybe some people knew what was going to come, but it seemed to me that there were a number of people taken by surprise. And she began by saying that there had been, at a previous meeting, a statement made by a board member regarding essentially the committee assignment process, and that and it became a little bit confused there. But the sense was that a board member had asked to be excused for the year from being a member of the various committees that the board has, and that that had been agreed to by the president. And so what she was doing in the open session initially, not naming the board member, but wanting in the open session to correct the record. Well, it became obvious who it was that was being referred to, and this was school board member Larson, who objected vehemently to the discussion happening in this public session, suggesting that this was something that they needed to discuss either in an executive session or between the two of them, that this was an inappropriate situation. My sense about it was it was awkward because I began to think about that old phrase, two wrongs don't make a right. So if there had been an inappropriate statement made by a board member in an open session, then this seemed to be an inappropriate way to, in an open session, to deal with that. So I just looked, and my read of the audience and the rest of the board members was this was squirmily uncomfortable. It went on for about 10 minutes or so because Mr. Larson did object, and they had a discussion regarding whether this point of order needed to be heard, and ultimately the president would decide upon it, and she ruled it out of order, his point of order. So it, as I say, was uncomfortable to the point where at the end of the meeting, members of the audience who had an opportunity at person to be heard stood up and said, you know, we don't need to hear your squabbles. Take care of them. But that's not something we're here to listen to. And so I looked at it as an anomaly. I don't think I have seen that happening. And certainly if there's been some disagreement, one would think that it would be handled. And it revealed a kind of an interesting situation since there was certainly an allegation that someone had lied, and given the board's very, very real rules regarding anyone who's testifying, who steps up to the microphone and wants to talk about something, that you don't either provide allegations or malign or otherwise in the session talk about people, this seemed to be not adhering to the kind of principles that they had set for the sessions. So I'm not sure. Maybe it's over and done. Maybe there will be some continuing discussion. I don't know. But it provided a sit-up, certainly, because people sort of sat up and said, oh, what is this? It seemed...
I'll wake you up.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Well, you know, it is kind of... It's an interesting conversation, if I'm tracking it right, Mike. They do publicly... they don't, behind closed doors, or they're not supposed to, do committee assignments. They normally do that in the view of the school board president says who she is.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Appointing, and then the board, of course, has a chance to object, and they could vote on it. I mean, it's rarely, I don't even think I remember it ever happening, but maybe it has. But so it is a public process.
Well, sure. The problem was there was this, one person speaking, and the person who was being spoken about didn't really have an opportunity to say anything of that, whether that was true, false, or indifferent, or present another view. And it appeared that he did have a different view. But
was
we're coming.
Was he not at the last meeting?
I cannot tell you that. So what I would have to say is we're coming to the end of our time.
Okay.
I invite you and listeners to take a listen
and see
what you think. But
that'll be one worthwhile listening to. And then Tuesday's Palmer City Council meeting will be next up. Mike.
Back up at it. Okay. Thank you, Citizen Lobbyist. Have a good day.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Citizen Lobbyist, broadcast on Thursdays at 8 a.m. and repeated at 5 p.m. on Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. You can find the podcast at radiofreepalmer.org. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions, please email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.